So our speaker today is Dr. Merritt Jones, and he's from Mullard Space Science Laboratory, and to the best of my knowledge, it's somewhere just outside of London in the UK. And I actually pulled up the website today to look at where Mullard was, and I saw what looked to be an English manor house set in the countryside. So I don't know if that's where you work, Garrett, but that's quite impressive. So you'll have to tell us a little bit more about that. Let's see, I first met Garrett when he was doing a postdoc in our group several years ago, and he was interested at that time in studying signatures of comet tails in the solar wind. And since then, he's been involved with a number of the different fields and particles teams on Cassini, including the magnetometer, the MIMI instrument, and now he's back in the UK working on CAPS. So he's got a great breadth of experience. Today he's going to talk about really an amazing discovery that he's made of a debris belt or rings around Rhea. The title of his talk is Rings Around a Moon? The Puzzling Case of Rhea. So I'll hand it over to Garrett.
Thanks very much, Marcia. Mm-hmm. So I work at the Mullard Space Science Laboratory, which is part of University College London. In the late 1960s, the university was given a grant by the Mullard Electronics Company, which is now part of Philips, to set up a space science laboratory. And because of lack of space in central London, they found this lovely manor house around 30 miles south of central London. So it's on top of a hill overlooking a beautiful countryside. So it's quite a pleasant place to work. So there are about 150 of us here. So, so I'm going to talk about really puzzling observations made by Cassini during a flyby of Rhea in 2005, and then we followed up with further observations in 2007. So if we move from the opening slide to the next page. I just, before I start, I'd like to thank several people and teams that have contributed to this work. So on the MIMI team, my colleagues Elias Roussos and Norbert Krupp and colleagues have made a huge contribution to this. Elias especially did much of the modelling to get the results that are presented here. And the MIMI team is led by Tom Kremeges of the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. I'm also presenting observations from the CAPS instrument, and that's led by Dave Young of the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. Also be showing images from the imaging team on Cassini, the PIs, Caroline Porco. I'd also like to thank Tillman Denk and Matt Tiscreno of that team for discussions regarding various aspects of this work, and also be reporting on observations near Rhea made by several other instruments, including UVIS, RPWS, the magnetometer, and the CDA teams. Okay, so I'll move on to the next slide. So most of the results reported on here from one instrument in particular, and that's MIMI, the magnetospheric imaging instrument, and there are three parts to this. The part that's shown on the screen here is called LEMS, which stands for the Low Energy Magnetospheric Measurement System. So this was mostly designed and built at the Max Planck Institute for Solar System Research in Katrenburg-Lindau in Germany. And it's designed to detect very energetic ions and electrons. So the energy ranges are shown there. So they're really energetic particles. There are solid-state detectors inside this instrument, which detect these particles out in the solar wind and also in Saturn's magnetosphere. So if we move on to the next slide, also we'll be showing data from the Cassini Plasma Spectrometer, or CAPS, and that also has different sections, and the data I'll be showing is from ELS, the electron spectrometer.
Excuse me, Garrett?
Yes?
Can I interrupt just a second?
Sure.
There seems to be a bit of noise on the line. Is it distracting to people? Should I try and get that eliminated, or are you guys okay? Do you hear it, Garrett?
Yeah, I have a slight echo, but I'm okay to carry on.
Any comments? All right. Keep going, Garrett. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So the electron spectrometer, the lead co-investigator for that is Andrew Coates here at MSSL. So this instrument detects electrons at a lower energy range than LEMS, the part of MIMI I just described. So it's actually mounted on an actuator so that it sweeps the sky like a windshield wiper, scanning back and forth to get to measure electrons and ions coming from different parts of the sky. And it covers an energy range lower, as I mentioned, than LEMS, from half an electron volt up to 26 kilo electron volts. Okay, so if we move on to the next slide, we have an image of Cassini with the installation removed, so you can see where all the different instruments and other components are. And CAPS and MIMI LEMS are mounted on the fields and particles palette at the center there at the right. So these instruments can't see particles coming from every direction at any one time. It depends on the orientation of the spacecraft, and also the CAPS is controlled by this actuation I mentioned earlier. LEMS also has been rotated to get better coverage of the sky as well, but for most of the time it's fixed. So the direction we're looking in and seeing these particles coming from is controlled by the orientation of the spacecraft. So if we move on to the next slide, this shows the trajectory of the prime and extended or equinox missions of Cassini. So we're in the equinox mission now, as you know. So we've completed numerous orbits of Saturn and covered a wide range of environments in the magnetosphere and passed many of the moons while doing that. So the outer blue ellipse there is the orbit of Iapetus. The next one in is Hyperion, and then just inside that you can see Titan. And you can see that the trajectory of Cassini passes close to Titan's orbit very often, and that's the reason that Titan, because it's by far the most massive moon, it's very easy to control, or relatively easy to, I don't want to belittle the work, a really complex navigation problem. By making close flybys of Titan, you can change the orbit of Cassini, and so you'll see that Cassini passes close to Titan many times. And of course, as well as the Titan flybys, we have many close flybys of other moons as well, the icy moons. So if we move on to the next slide, there's an overview of the moons of Saturn prepared by David Seal. And the top panel there, you can see the relative sizes of the moons. You can see the limb of Saturn at the bottom of that upper panel, just to scale. And you can see that Titan is by far the largest moon, and you can also tell that it has a very thick atmosphere. And then next in size is Rhea in the center there, and after that Iapetus, and then going down the size through Enceladus and Mimas, etc., to the very small moons which have been enlarged in this figure. So at the bottom part of that panel shows where these icy moons orbit Saturn, and all of the moons in the bottom panel are within Saturn's magnetosphere all the time. So the magnetosphere is this magnetic cage surrounding Saturn, where the solar wind can't easily penetrate. So this so Saturn's magnetic field holds off the solar wind. So it's an environment very close to the planet, which is quite stable, and then further out it gets more variable as different processes like reconnection, etc., occur in the tail. So these icy moons, because they sit in the this region close to the planet, they're constantly bombarded by particles which are trapped by Saturn's magnetosphere. So if we move on to the next page, next slide, this figure shows Saturn, and just as an example, the orbit of Enceladus, shown in blue. And Enceladus is sitting inside the magnetosphere. The magnetosphere is largely controlled by Saturn's magnetic field, so as the planet rotates, it drags its magnetic field around with it, and particles which are trapped in the radiation belts, the equivalent of the Earth's Van Allen belts, travel north and south, bounce north and south along the magnetic field lines. So as the planet rotates, the magnetosphere rotates, and these particles that are trapped in the magnetosphere, in the radiation belts, also move around the planet as well. So the moons are trapped or orbit within this this constant soup of energetic ions and electrons that are in the magnetosphere. So the arrows at the bottom show the general direction. So most of the plasma, that's the charged ions and electrons, move in the direction of the red arrow. So there is a slight complication. So all the two green arrows show that all the ions, all the protons and the low energy electrons move around the planet in the same direction as the planet rotates, but energetic electrons, that's above around 1 MeV for the orbit of Enceladus, they actually, because of drifts, particle drifts caused by the shape of the magnetic field, etc., actually move in the opposite direction to the rotation of the planet. So if we move on to the next slide, these particles in the radiation belt can be lost. So they can strike a moon, as shown for particle A. It comes in, strikes the moon, it's absorbed by the surface, and it's lost to the magnetosphere. For case B, that one has struck a dust grain which is orbiting Saturn, for example, in the E-ring. So that's also lost to the magnetosphere. And in the case of Enceladus, the example C here, the plume of Enceladus is also an absorber of these energetic particles trapped in Saturn's magnetosphere. So if we move on to the next slide. So when energetic particles in the radiation belt strike a moon or another obstacle such as a dust grain, material is lost. So if you if LEMS crosses, LEMS is the part of the MIMI instrument on Cassini, when Cassini crosses a region which has passed close to a moon or another absorbing obstacle, we see a drop in the fluxes. So particles will strike a moon, and then when we pass close to that part of the magnetosphere, we'll see a drop in the fluxes of energetic particles. And these drops in the fluxes are termed microsignatures. So in this this cartoon, we've got a moon with a magnetic field. We've zoomed into a region around the moon, and the magnetic field in blue is the magnetic field of Saturn. And the red curtain is where you see a decrease in energetic particles. So they've been lost to the moon. So if Cassini crosses any part of that curtain, it sees a drop roughly the same size as the moon. But eventually microsignatures, these dropouts, eventually refill. Sometimes they can wrap around the planet, around Saturn more than once, but usually they refill. So you only see them when you're fairly close to the moon, before the magnetospheric particles have refilled the wake.
Yes. Question. I don't know if you want people to interrupt with questions or if you want to pause every once in a while, but the rippliness of the red zone is just because of variability in the magnetosphere. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. There are currents in the magnetosphere, so we find more often than not that these dropouts don't occur exactly where you expect them to. So we think that these electric currents are moving the magnetic field around, and so this signature moves around as well. So you can think of maybe a smokestack giving out lots of smoke, and instead of a straight trail as it moves downwind, it encounters a crosswind, so it'll move from side to side. So we don't always see the dropouts exactly where we expect it to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
So, yeah, I'm happy for anyone to interrupt with any questions if anything comes to mind.
Good.
Okay, thanks. So if we move on to the next slide, so it's another version of the slide a couple of pages back. So the red region here shows where magnetic field lines of Saturn have passed close to, in this case, Enceladus. So this is termed the L shell. So this is a way of describing a surface, a set of magnetic fields that have passed close to a moon. So the L shell of Enceladus is a region of the magnetosphere where the magnetic field lines thread the equator near a moon. So if Cassini crosses any part of this region that's marked in red, then it'll see a dropout caused by particles being lost to Enceladus. So instead of bouncing up and down the magnetic field lines, they've struck the moon, so we see a decrease in the fluxes. Okay, so if we move on to the next slide. So this is an example of one of these microsignatures. So this is for one of the larger moons called Tethys, and this is data from MIMI lens. So each one of those lines represents data from a different energy channel. So we're detecting electrons with LEMS, and the key at the right shows you the different energies. So at the bottom we have electrons from 20 to 32 kiloelectron volts, and that's the topmost trace in this graph. So as you move to higher energies, we change color, and at the very high energy end, because, as I mentioned earlier, very high energy electrons go around Saturn in the opposite direction, we start losing the microsignature and don't see it anymore. So the scale from left to right, the x-axis, is measured in Tethys radii, and you'll see that the drop is exactly one Tethys diameter wide, so it's exactly the width of the moon. This is exactly what we'd expect to see. So when we pass through magnetic fields that have passed close to Tethys, we're seeing a big drop in the energetic particles because they've struck the surface, and we can't observe them anymore because they've been lost. So this covers about 1.5 hours of data from a flyby of Tethys in 2005. So that's what we expect to see at most of the moons. So if we go on to the next slide, this just gives a brief overview of Rhea. Radius is just over 750 kilometers, and it orbits at 8.7 Saturn radii from the planet Saturn. So the close flyby and the closest to date occurred on day 330 of 2005, towards the end of November, and we approached to within 500 kilometers of the surface, so directly downstream of the moon in the co-rotation flow. So if you remember the rotation of Saturn, we passed downstream of that flow of plasma carried by Saturn's magnetic field. And there was a more distant flyby in August 2007, which I'll return to later. So the surface of Rhea, as you can see from that image, it's an extremely old surface. It's practically saturated with craters. There are some regions with large fractures and a few fairly young, or relatively young, craters on the scale thought to be of tens of millions of years old. But there aren't any very young regions like you see it in Enceladus with no craters. It seems to be a very old, battered terrain. So if we move on to the next slide, it shows the geometry of the encounter that occurred in November 2005. So we've got Rhea right in the middle of the figure. Saturn is towards the upper right, that where that blue arrow on the right is pointing. And Cassini was traveling inbound towards Saturn at the time. So the track of Cassini is shown there in red. We passed through that wake, the region shown in green here, which is downstream of this flow of plasma that continuously flows past the moon. So also shown on this figure is the Hill Sphere of Rhea. Now this is a region where the gravitational field of Rhea dominates over that of Saturn. So in an ideal world, if there are no other moons and Saturn was a perfect sphere, etc., if you were to put a particle in orbit around Rhea inside the Hill Sphere, it would stay in orbit. But outside, it couldn't stay in orbit. It would orbit. It would be in free orbit around Saturn itself. But in reality, because of other complications like other moons and the oblateness of Saturn, for example, the stable orbits inside the Hill Sphere probably only extend up to roughly halfway out, maybe a little more inside the Hill Sphere of Saturn. But it's basically the region where Rhea's gravitational field dominates. So the diameter of the Hill Sphere is about 15 Rhea diameters, or very roughly 11,000 kilometers. So roughly the scale of the Earth, the Hill Sphere. So the trajectory of Cassini from left to right went through the wake and also just slightly south of Rhea's equator. So we were about 200 kilometers south of the equator, which doesn't really show up very clearly on this figure. Okay, so if we move to the next slide, then we can see what LEMS actually saw when we carried out this close flyby of Rhea. And you'll recall the Tethys signature was a really clear dropout, very sharp, and then on the other side, the fluxes returned to the levels they were before. We have these really odd features on either side of Rhea itself. So right in the middle, around 8 minutes or so, we see the sharp drop due to Rhea itself. But on either side, we see these periods where the electron fluxes were decreasing gradually as we approached Rhea, and then going outbound, they returned again. Rather than returning back up to a fixed level, they returned gradually. And this figure shows the data from several energy channels from LEMS, which are shown in the key at the bottom right there. So these wings of the dropout were completely unexpected, and that was a huge puzzle, and some may argue still is. So if we move on to the next slide, we have a cartoon of Cassini going past Rhea, and we've shown to the same scale this decrease in electron fluxes. It's a log scale, so if you were to plot it in a linear scale, it would be much sharper than or much deeper than this. So I'm going to try and play you some audio of this flyby. So this will last about 25 seconds. And represents the width of this plot, which we have on this figure. So we've taken white noise, and we changed the volume by the change in the fluxes detected by the LEMS instrument. So if you listen carefully, you'll hear the volume of the flux decreasing as we get closer to Rhea, and then you'll hear a gap of a few seconds, and then the fluxes will return and will increase again in volume. Okay, so I'll start that, and it'll last about 25 seconds. One way of describing the curious thing we were seeing is if you're driving in a car during a heavy rainstorm, and you hear the sound of the rain on the windshield and the roof of your car. When you go in, under a bridge, you expect that sound to stop and then to restart again on the other side, and that's what we expect to hear or to detect when we're going past these moons. But instead, when we're approaching this moon, or the equivalent of the bridge, the rain slows down, or the flux decreases well before we expect it to, and gradually decreases, and then on the other side, instead of coming back abruptly, it gradually increases again. Okay, so...
So, Darren?
Yes.
Is there an audio file in the PowerPoint or not?
There isn't, no.
Oh,
I was only showing it, but...
That's fine. And then the audio is made from the MIMI lens data, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay, all right.
So
that was cool. Thanks.
Okay, so are there any questions at this point? Okay, so I'll move on then. So the next slide. The figure at the upper right shows Rhea looking from the north, with Cassini moving from bottom to top, and then the color of the line represents the fluxes detected by LEMS. So this flow of plasma trapped around Saturn is shown by the red arrow, the large red arrow, moving from left to right, and you can see in the wake we saw a decrease in that flux as expected, but this wide decrease on either side was unexpected. So so what causes the extended low energy dropout on either side of Rhea? The inbound boundary was at 22 minutes past the hour, and outbound is at it was at 52 past the hour, plus or minus a few minutes. But the Hill sphere radius is just over 7.6 Rhea radii, and that was crossed at 25 past and 51 past the hour, as I show there. So these times are fairly close to the times when Cassini entered and left the Hill sphere, the region where material could possibly be gravitationally bound by Rhea. So it may be a coincidence, but it is curious that this dropout has got the same scale as the sphere. So if we move on to the next slide, and there's a different version of the cartoon I showed earlier with the curtain. So when we pass close to Rhea, instead of just seeing a sharp dropout exactly the same scale as the moon, we also have a wider region caused by something absorbing electrons, so as represented by that white fuzzy region surrounding the moon. So we have an extended microsignature. The only other place where we have an extended microsignature like this is at Enceladus, and we understand that much better. That is due to the plume of material coming out of Enceladus, and as I showed earlier, the magnetospheric particles can strike dust grains in the plume and they're lost in that way. But around Rhea, we had no obvious explanation for the decrease in electrons. So if we move on to the next slide, this shows observations by several different fields and particles instruments on Cassini during this flyby. So at the top, we have Rhea viewed from the north, with the plasma flowing from the top to bottom. So the pale yellow disk is the scale of the Hill sphere. And the next panel down, we have the LEMS observations at two energies, and you can see the scale of the decrease relatively close to the scale of the Hill sphere, but not exactly. Then next down is the CAPS ELS data, which shows the electrons. So they also showed a decrease on either side of Rhea. And then we have the first color panel, and that's another way of showing the CAPS data over a larger energy range. And if you look at to the left of that panel, you can see the energies in electron volts per charge for those electrons. So that red line is where most of the plasma is, that red region running all the way across the figure except for the gap in the middle. Then it's the high energy end of the ELS data, you can see this dark blue region, which is the wake, and then on either side you can see the decrease in fluxes at very high energies in the CAPS data as well. So the next panel is CAPS IMS. So IMS is part of CAPS, which detects ions rather than electrons, so it detects positive ions. Those pulses at the start and the end of that are due to actuation. So as I mentioned earlier, CAPS is on this like a windshield wiper. So that was operating up to that time where you see the dotted line, and then it was fixed for the rear flyby itself. And you see that ions are missing right from the middle of that plot where we were passed downstream of Rio's wake, and ions were unable to reach the spacecraft. Next we show the electron number density from the radio instrument RPWS. So it's, there are hints that there's something going on there roughly the same time as in the other instruments, but it doesn't really stand out. And then the last two panels show data from the mag instrument, the magnetometer. So at the bottom you see the magnitude of the magnetic field, and there's this bump in the wake of Rhea. And what happens is in the wake, because plasma hits the surface, you have a vacuum, or a stronger vacuum, an absence of particles in the wake downstream of Rhea. So the magnetic field increases in strength to make up for the absence of these particles. So that's why you see this bump in the magnetic field strength immediately downstream of the moon. So we looked at all these data sets together, the magnetometer and the RPWS and CAPS and MIMI, and we're really puzzled by what we were seeing. There was one possible explanation for this wide feature, maybe a wake, so you can a wider wake, so you can think of a boat moving through water, and its bow wave can be very wide. However, for the speed of the plasma near Rhea, you wouldn't expect it to expand that quickly so close to the moon. You can expect features to move at sharp angles to the flow of the plasma north and south of the moon along the magnetic field lines, but in this direction we didn't expect to see such features, so it was a real puzzle. So if we move on to the next slide, so if we can't explain this by a plasma wake, so there must be something absorbing electrons there. So one possibility is neutral gas. So Rhea could have an exosphere, and it almost certainly does have an exosphere. We expect it to have it because it's sitting in this plasma, and it's continuously bombarded by energetic particles. And when these strike the surface, they kick up material such as atoms and molecules. So around the moon, we'd expect to see this very thin exosphere or atmosphere. And Sauer and Strobel published a work in 2005, where they modelled the expected effect of this process called sputtering on the surface. And they inferred that Rhea could possess a thin exosphere. So that could be one explanation for why we were seeing a decrease in a depletion in electrons around the moon, if this gas, which could be surrounding the moon, was absorbing them. So another possible explanation is a dust cloud. Now, we expected to see a dust cloud around Rhea for, in some ways, similar reasons to why we'd expect to see an exosphere, because Rhea is continuously bombarded by interplanetary dust grains and E-ring particles as well. So these are continuously raining down onto the surface. And when they do that, they throw up ejector, other small particles. A few of them may escape, but most of them don't, so they arc out over the surface and then come back down onto the Rhea's surface somewhere else on the surface of the moon. So because they're continuously bombarded by these particles, you expect to see a cloud of ejecta, around the moon. So this was first detected by the Galileo spacecraft at the Galilean satellites around Jupiter. There's no question that we expected to see these dust particles around Rhea. And as an aside, by measuring the fluxes of these ejecta particles, it's a good way of measuring how much material is coming into the Saturn system, because we know the mass of Rhea, and maybe even try to get the age of the Saturn ring system. So models were of this process had been published already before this flyby by several workers as listed here. So we expected to see this increase in dust around the around Rhea and other moons. So if we move on to the next image, so the next slide. This shows an image of Rhea using the MIMI Inca instrument. So it's, as you may have heard before by in presentations by Don Mitchell and others from the MIMI team, Inca detects energetic neutral atoms. So it's a camera, but instead of detecting photons, it detects atoms. So MIMI Inca was fortunately on during this Rhea flyby, and this shows one of those images with the disk of Rhea in the middle, and it's one way of measuring the column density, the thickness of any atmosphere that's surrounding Rhea. So when we fly by Titan, Inca shows a bright halo around Titan, because the atmosphere is there when energetic particles in the magnetosphere hit the atmosphere, they release energetic neutral atoms. So we see this glow around Titan, which helps determine the thickness of the atmosphere there. And we can use the same thing, same technique at Rhea. But we didn't see any significant enhancement in the energetic neutral atom flux around Rhea at all. So it gives an upper limit for how much gas is there. And also UVIS, the ultraviolet imaging spectrometer, can detect the presence of oxygen and molecular oxygen, and from observations by UVIS, there was no positive detection of O or O2 around Rhea. So these combined suggest that if there is gas there, there's not much there, so the exosphere is quite tenuous. And to see the decrease in the electron fluxes that LEM sees, we'd need much higher column densities, much, much higher than the upper limits returned by Inca and UVIS. So I think we can quite safely conclude that neutral gas is not the reason why electrons are depleted around Rhea. So if we move on to the next slide. So we move away from Rhea for a moment, just to briefly mention that solid grains and bodies can absorb electrons. Earlier on in the talk I mentioned, I showed the example of a dust grain near Enceladus absorbing a particle. By using this technique, we can learn a lot about the regions around Saturn, and can even detect bodies before they're observed by cameras. So this figure in the middle shows the fluxes measured by LEMS during one periapsis pass in 2006. So this shows the data from LEMS for three energy channels for electrons, labeled E5, E4, and E6. So the dipole L-shell, the scale at the bottom, is you can think of it as the equivalent to the distance from Saturn. We were quite close to the equator. So the arrows show the lines when we were moving inwards towards Saturn, and then we moved out again, and you can see how the flux has changed moving away from the planet. Now, there are two tiny moons of Saturn discovered by the imaging team, called Methone and Anthe. They're only 2 or 3 kilometers across each, and the positions of their orbits are shown by the vertical red lines there. And you can see that in the LEMS data we saw wide decreases both inbound and outbound near the orbits of these two moons, suggesting that there's something at the orbits of these moons absorbing electrons. And each dropout there is around 1,000 kilometers across. Now, those two moons, as I mentioned, are only a couple of kilometers across, so these dropouts are far too wide to be explained by the moons themselves. So several people from the MIMI team, led by Ilias Roussos, proposed that these dropouts are actually evidence for possible ring arcs or rings at the orbits of these small moons, Methone and Ansi. And then if we move on to the next slide,
Gary,
sure enough, yes?
Before you go on, why is the dropout associated with Ansi displaced to the larger L shell?
As I mentioned earlier, there are currents moving dropouts around, so the magnetic field carrying a signature can be moved inwards or outwards away or towards from Saturn. So the same reason as we put that wiggle in the sort of curtain cartoon showing an example of a dropout near a moon. But I also should mention that because of the persistence of some of these dropouts, because they might not persist all the way around the orbits, it's possible that both of those dropouts have come from one moon or arc, and one of the signatures inbound has moved away in one direction and the other one moved outbound. So it basically shows that there's definitely something at approximately that distance absorbing particles.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
So if we move on to the next slide, you can see that the imaging team targeted these moons and took long exposures or several exposures and co-added them. And sure enough, ANSI and Methone have got arcs. So one or both of these arcs are responsible probably for these dropouts that we saw in the LEMS data in the preceding slide. So before these images were taken, showing the existence of these arcs, the existence of at least one of them, if not two, was already detected by the LEMS instrument. So it's when these dropouts are observed by LEMS, it's a bit difficult to infer how far away the source is. So they can be really close, or if they're far away, they might be responsible for a deeper absorption. But because they're quite persistent, they can spiral around Saturn, be detected quite far away from the source. So one example of such a detection was Pioneer 11, which flew by Saturn just before the Voyagers did in the early 1980s, detected a similar dropout at the orbit of the G ring before it was observed by any spacecraft. So if we move on to the next slide, we return to Rhea, and this shows data from three instruments during the 2005 flyby. Panel A shows data from CDA, the Cosmic Dust Analyzer, the dust instrument, and that shows the number density of dust particles detected by that instrument and the size range it covered. So you can see the Hill Sphere is shown, or the boundary of the Hill Sphere is shown by the dotted lines, the vertical dotted lines. And close to the moon, we see this increase in fluxes, probably caused by, or almost certainly caused by, the bombardment of the surface by interplanetary dust particles. So what was expected based on earlier models. The RPWS instrument can also detect dust particles. So when dust strikes Cassini, it creates a small plasma cloud. And this can be detected by the radio instrument. So the middle panel shows where these dust detections occurred during the flyby. And again, you can see sharp peak near closest approach to Rhea. And then the bottom panel shows data from the MIMI INCA instrument. So this is a little harder to interpret, and it's not entirely sure what size range we're detecting, but with the INCA instrument there are occasional discharges between the plates of the instrument that, which detect the energetic neutral atoms, and you can see that there was a slight increase in the this current due to these discharges at closest approach to Rhea, again suggesting that there are small dust particles striking the instrument, and we saw an increase near Rhea. So dust is definitely there, but it was expected. So if we move to the next slide, so this shows how we estimate how much material is around Rhea. So this cartoon for the 2005 flyby is looking towards Saturn, and Rhea is the disk in the middle, and surrounded by the Hill sphere, with the plasma moving from left to right. And the blue vertical lines are Saturn's magnetic field, and they're constantly moving from left to right as Saturn rotates in the background. The yellow arrow shows an example electron moving along the magnetic field. And just to the right of Rhea, you can see where Cassini passed closest to the Moon in the wake, quite close to the surface. So if we move on to the next slide, you can see that if we take this example electron, as it bounces north and south along these blue magnetic field lines, it travels south, and then when it gets close to Saturn, its direction reverses, and then it travels north again along the magnetic field line until it gets close to Saturn again, and then reverses direction. And so these trapped particles are constantly moving north and south as the magnetic field is dragged from left to right by the rotation of Saturn. So we know the scale of the Hill sphere, and for different energies of electrons, we can estimate how quickly they drift through the Hill sphere. So the red lines show the integrated the path length through the Hill sphere before it was eventually detected by Cassini. So if we move back to the next slide, the observed dust flux by the CDA instrument was not out of the ordinary. It's fairly close to the E-ring peak number density, so there wasn't the huge increase in dust necessary to explain the decrease seen in the electrons. So if we were to take a spherical dust cloud caused by bombardment of the surface, the shape of that dust cloud would fall off too rapidly with distance to explain the shape of the electron decrease we saw as well. So another thing that helps us understand, or gives us a clue at least to what is going on, is that CAPS was looking at electrons that were coming straight through the Hill sphere rather than bouncing north and south, whereas LEMS at the bottom right was detecting the electrons that bouncing north and south several times through the Hill sphere before being detected. So we had the fluxes from the two instruments, and we can combine those to try and understand the possible distribution of material in the Hill sphere to explain what we saw. So if we move on to the next slide, the only solution that we were able to come up with was that rather than a spherical cloud around Rhea, we needed a debris disk, a disk of material fairly close to the equatorial plane. And so the particles or the electrons detected by LEMS crossed this surface several times north and south before being detected by Cassini. So another advantage of having material in an equatorial orbit is that it's more stable. This isn't my field of research at all, but if you go to high inclination orbits around Rhea, they're not stable for long timescales at all. So if you have particles in an orbit near the equator, they're in much more stable orbits and can stay there for much longer time periods. So an equatorial debris in an equatorial orbit makes much more sense than a spherical distribution of trapped particles. The disk would be mainly observable by its effect on the charged particles, so those that travel through the disk before reaching Cassini, and it can be of low optical depth, so that means it wouldn't necessarily be a very obviously easy to observe debris disk, because the particles that we were detecting went through the debris disk, if it's there, several times rather than just once. It doesn't need to be as thick or as dense, as optically dense as needed to be observable with a camera, for example. So by combining the caps and the lens data, we found a model, a fit to the observations that with a thin equatorial debris disk that agreed with both the caps and the lens data. So Elias Roussos, who did a lot of this work, he came up with a relationship between the typical or largest grain size in the debris disk and the optical depth of the disk if we were to observe it from one side. And I'm not showing them here, but the images obtained by the imaging team between the reports of this explanation for the electron decrease and now haven't been able to detect any sign of a debris disk. So if it's there, it's extremely difficult to observe, and it pushes the sizes of the particles or pebbles or boulders in this debris disk to a large scale. So we're talking about centimeters, decimeters, or even meters in size for the particles in the debris disk. So if that's true, then it is a real puzzle, because when you have large particles, you also expect small ones to be there as well. So when they hit each other, you get a cascade of sizes. You have big ones, slightly smaller ones, and then going to smaller and smaller sizes. But they should be observable by the imaging instruments on Cassini, and they haven't been detected so far. So if the debris disk is there, and the typical sizes of these bodies or particles in the disk are large, we'd expect to see small particles as well, but that hasn't been detected so far. So it's a real puzzle to explain everything that Cassini is telling us about the region around Rhea. Okay, so if we move on to the next slide, there are some aspects of the electron fluxes which are consistent with there being absorbing obstacles orbiting Rhea. So this figure shows the inbound data from that flyby in 2005 from several different energies. So each panel shows electrons of different energies. And as you go to higher energies, the width of some of these features increases. So that tends to agree with what you'd expect to see. So as you go to higher energies, the electrons have slightly larger gyro radii. So that means if you have an electron trapped by a magnetic field, it spirals around the magnetic field. But if it has a higher energy, then the size of that spiral gets bigger. So if you have energetic electrons, they follow a larger helix or spiral, and they will form a wider dropout if they hit a particle. So as you go to higher energies, these signatures do widen, which sort of agrees with what we'd expect to see. But the rate at which they're increasing is a bit larger than expected. But another aspect of this is that electrons going through the Hill sphere around Rhea go through at different rates. So if you go to higher energies, they spend longer going north and south through the Hill sphere before being detected by Cassini. And combining all these different factors to explain the observations we have is quite complicated. So all we can do is give ballpark figures, and the debris disk explanation is the only one that we've been able to come up with that explains what we see. So if we move on to the next slide, one of the more curious aspects of the data returned by LAMMS is these really short dropouts. So I showed you the really wide decrease earlier on, which you can see in the top panel. For example, in the red line at the top, you see it covers, it decreases quite far away from Rhea, and then increases again gradually on the other side. But on either side of the deep decrease, which are caused by the moon itself, you also have these very brief dropouts lasting only a few seconds. So the bottom panel shows some of these features in the data from the high time resolution channel from LEMS. And you can see three clear dropouts on one side of Rhea, another three on the other side, and then another possible one towards the end of this period. So if we move to the next slide, the simplest explanation for this is that there could be extended arcs or rings of material orbiting Rhea in its equatorial plane. So these dropouts, this set of six dropouts, are almost symmetrical, and you can fit the positions of three discrete rings to the locations of these dropouts. So maybe they're caused by another process such as features on either side of the wake downstream of Rhea, but the symmetry is very intriguing. So we'll have to look for those features again during future flybys. So just to show you at the bottom there, we returned to the data from Tethys, and you can see how that compared to what we see at Rhea. So at Tethys we see a really sharp dropout, and Rhea we have these features on either side. Also the dropout in the wake at Rhea is a bit more ragged because of differences in the plasma temperature, the rate at which this wake fills in downstream of the moon. So these brief dropouts are a really curious aspect of the data, and the symmetry could be a coincidence, but if it is, it's an amazing one. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. Just to briefly show you that when Voyager 1 made its closest approach to Rhea in the early 1980s, a wide decrease in electron fluxes was observed then as well. So at the bottom panel you have a plot covering 12 hours, and then the next panel zooms into 10 minutes, and then the top panel moves into a period covering only 3 minutes around the closest approach to Rhea. So you can see in the middle panel that there's a broad decrease around Rhea, and suggestions of small dips as well. So these were observed further away from Rhea than the ones during the close flyby in 2005. And interpreting the data from Voyager is complicated because the pitch angle, the direction in which the instrument was looking, was constantly changing, and there are lots of data gaps as you can see in the plots.
How far away was this flyby?
To be honest, I can't remember, but it's well outside the Hill sphere, so much further away than the flyby by Cassini in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we move on to the next slide, we have further data from a flyby 5,700 kilometers downstream in August 2007. So this is just outside the Hill Sphere. So we've shown on the scale of L shell, so this is distance from Saturn, the data from LEMS during those two flybys. So the 2005 data is at the bottom and then 2007 data at the top. So we were further downstream, but again you can see a hint of a broad feature around Rhea. It's not as obvious or as symmetrical as it was in 2005 in the LEMS data at least, but there is an indication that the broad depletion is there again. It's been shifted radially again by these currents that move, or we believe by these currents that move these signatures in and out away from Saturn. And also we see these short period dips again surrounding the dropout. We suggest that they, once they're formed near Rhea, they're carried downstream, so you can detect them further away. But we've looked at the positions of these dropouts, and because the whole signature has been moved inwards towards Saturn, it's a bit difficult to be completely sure that we're seeing them at the same distance from the axis of the wake as when we observed them in 2005 during the close flyby. Okay, so LEMS showed a hint of a broad decrease being there again at the same scale as the Hill Sphere. And if we move on to the next slide, we show the data from CAPS ELS during the 2007 flyby. And this time ELS shows the broad decrease more clearly than LEMS. So on either side we see this decrease in electron fluxes inbound and then outbound again on the other side. So the change in the spikiness of the data is just a change in the time resolution of the instrument. So for the flyby itself, at around 0:50 hours, it changed into a high resolution mode, so that's why the data suddenly gets more spiky. But you can see on either side of Rhea, we again saw a broad decrease in electrons, again roughly the scale of the Hill Sphere. So the feature is still there. Okay, so if we move on to the next slide, I can briefly mention future plans. So for the Equinox mission, just over a year from now, we've got a targeted flyby of Rhea planned to within 100 kilometers of the surface. So the flyby speed will be 8.6 kilometers a second, and we'll pass close to Rhea's north pole. So in 2005, Rhea was on the day side of Saturn. This time we'll be on the night side, but again, Cassini will be moving inbound towards the planet. So LEMS and ELS will be placed in orientations designed to check for the recurrence of these features I've been describing. So we've seen the wide wake already in 2007, so we expect to see it again. Will these small scale dips be present again during this flyby and at similar distances? The instruments will also be fixed so that we get good pitch angle coverage. So we're seeing electrons that are bouncing north-south along the magnetic field lines, but also those that stay fairly close to the equator of Saturn. So we hope to get good coverage of the electrons from several directions. Okay, so that's occurring a year from now. So if we move to the next slide, is there any other evidence for the existence of a debris disk around Rhea? And if we move to the next slide, we have an image of Rhea captured by the imaging instrument on Cassini, ISS. This is taken at infrared wavelengths, and it shows a feature that was first discussed on an online forum on manspaceflight.com, where amateurs and several professional planetary scientists stitch together images as they're released onto the planetary data system, once they're released to the public. And some members there pointed out this curious feature. If you look at the image, the equator of Saturn is more or less in the center, it's horizontal in this view, and you can see a row of dark features running across the image from left to right. So it's a row of dark patches, and the position of these patches is actually very close to the equator. So if we move to the next slide, several images taken at different wavelengths with ISS have been combined, and if we zoom in onto one of these patches, you can see that these features, which are shown in blue here, are actually tend to occur on the eastward facing slopes of craters. So the colour's been stretched, it isn't natural at all. So these features tend to occur on these eastward facing sides of craters, and also at what appear to be high elevation regions. So if we move to the next slide, this is not inconsistent with material in orbit around Rhea's equator, so circular orbits, but orbits that are gradually decaying. So you can imagine a particle in orbit, and slowly its altitude is decreasing over time, and then eventually it will strike the surface. And if it's in a retrograde orbit, that's moving from right to left in this view, this has got north towards the top of the image, then they tend to strike the eastward facing slopes of craters and any high elevation regions. So if this scenario is correct, then the impact velocity for material in orbit such as this is around 460 meters per second. And that's fast, but it's not sort of hypervelocity speed. So you, so the impactors would probably fragment without forming large craters. So it's a curious idea. We're looking more closely at this, and it's extremely preliminary. It's just a very interesting set of features that were found by amateur observers, and we're paying a lot more attention to these now, and we'll study these features in more details over the coming months. So, as I said, very preliminary, but it is extremely curious that these features are occurring close to the equator and may have an explanation similar to the explanation we've put forward for the debris disk orbiting Rhea. Okay, so if we move on to the summary. Observations by MIMI lens and CAP-CLS clearly show that there's a deficit of electrons in the region around Rhea. Now, the only explanation that we've been able to come up with is that Rhea is surrounded by an electron-absorbing population of solid material. Whatever's going on there, it's an apparently unique moon-magnetosphere interaction. So from the model we produced to fit to the electron observations, we have three components to this material. Spherical ejector cloud, which was expected, flat equatorial disk of material, and maybe discrete rings or arcs at low altitudes. But these rings or arcs, if they're there, are also very difficult to explain, because you need something to constrain the orbits of particles into a narrow range of altitudes. So the next point is that the elephant in the room, there's no observational evidence so far. So the remote observations of Rhea by ISS hasn't detected any evidence for this orbiting material to date. If big boulders or pebbles are there, then we expect to also see smaller particles, but these haven't been detected to date. So a possible explanation is that the smaller particles are somehow removed. Maybe they're not stable, or they can be ground down by bombardment by magnetospheric particles, etc. But no easy explanation. So it is a big puzzle. And then finally, the equatorial surface features and other absorption signatures from other flybys are currently undergoing analysis. So I'll end with the final slide, which is just an artist's impression of what the region around Rhea may look like. Heavily exaggerated, but there could be a disk of boulders or pebbles orbiting Rhea in the equatorial plane. So So maybe in a year's time, in the March 2010 flyby, we'll get a lot more data to help us understand exactly what's going on. But whatever's going on at Rhea, it's unique, and we look forward to finding a few more pieces of the puzzle then. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Garen. That was a great talk, and your graphics are amazing. I expect that the artist representation on the left view graph is you, right? Because I know you're really good with Photoshop. Did you?
No, it wasn't.
No? That's lovely. So certainly there must be some questions for Garen. People want to chime in with their questions? No questions? I've got a couple, but so for the XXM, we're the extended mission. This is the 7 years that we're proposing to fly. I think we're trying to get some close Rhea flybys. Do you know what is in the plans for the XXM?
Yes, we've got several really close flybys on the scale of I think the closest is a couple of hundred kilometers. The next one out is less than 5,000 kilometers, and then quite a few other ones which are a bit further out. So if XSM is approved, then we're bound to get much more useful data. I mean, there are other techniques as well which we hope to use, such as UVIS, staring at a background star as it passes close to Rhea, or Rhea moves across the path between Cassini and the star. So there's a chance that if there are boulders orbiting Rhea, that we might see a dip in the starlight as these pass in front. So that's another technique that will need to be tried out if possible.
Is that being planned? Or
yes, there are plans. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool.
So with each flyby, I mean, we've got several more distant flybys that have also taken place, which I haven't shown here, but the data from IMI and CAPS are curious for several of those as well. So we've got a lot of work already, but we look forward to getting a more close flyby.
Anybody? Any other questions?
Yeah, question?
Question. When you first looked at your data, was your immediate reaction that you had a problem with your instrument, or was it more that you had something really interesting going on?
I think it was the latter. This flyby in 2005 occurred when we had a run of several amazing flybys during the past several of these moons. So within a period of 2 or 3 months, we had really close flybys of Tethys, Dione, and Rhea, and so we suddenly got all this fantastic data, and when we compared the new data side by side from the different flybys, it was clear that the Rhea data was unusual. There was no obvious explanation for it, but we were confident looking at the data from the other flybys that there was no obvious problem with the instrument, and we were seeing the feature in CAPS as well as MIMI, so that helped us be confident that there wasn't an instrumental effect.
Anyone else? Questions? Okay. Well, I guess we'll bring it to a close then. That was a really great talk, Garrett. It was fascinating. I really appreciate it. So just to let the participants know, in a month's time, we're going to have Ralph Lorenz talking about Titan. The title of his talk is A New Window on Titan's Winds and Internal Ocean. So that'll be at next month's Charm Telecon. And if anybody has any suggestions for topics they'd like to hear, whether it be additional science topics or even topics that pertain to engineering, running the spacecraft, just send an email to Charm Leads, and we'll try and get those in the schedule. I'm scheduling talks for the whole year, so now it's a good time to let us know about that. And with that, I will say goodbye to everyone, and again, thanks very much to Garrett.
Thanks very much, Marcia, and thanks everyone else for listening. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.